This week began with a Memorial Day unlike any other. Instead of parades or large gatherings, virtual ceremonies and online name readings helped friends and families recognize those who've fallen while serving their country. Here in Massachusetts, it was also the first day that a number of businesses and services were allowed to reopen, including barbershops, hair salons, plus retail shops are now allowed to offer curbside pickup. But in the nation's capital, the new normal feels a lot like the old, with the House Democrats' latest pandemic stimulus bill being called a liberal wish list and dead on arrival by Republicans in the Senate. Joining us now to talk about all of it is Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark of the 5th District. Congresswoman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's good to be with you and good to hear your voice.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And to that point, listeners, if you have a question for the Congresswoman, she will take your calls. Whether it's about the state or federal response to the pandemic or something else, you can call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Congresswoman, let's start with how you observed the Memorial Day weekend. What'd you do?
As I have been for the last few months, I spent time with my parents. We pre-recorded a message to our veterans and to Gold Star families. And I went and visited my own parents' grave and spent some time contemplating about them and how much we miss them and how much loss our communities have had to absorb during this very difficult time.
Were there a lot of people there?
There were not. It is a very small cemetery, but it was beautiful. But we sort of feel that loss. I think this Memorial Day was so poignant because we are not only thinking of those who sacrificed everything for us, but the 100,000 lives that we have lost here in the United States, and you know, almost 6,500 fellow Bay Staters have succumbed to this virus. And so loss and grief are all around us. And I think that what has been remarkable about this time is to see communities grappling with the most difficult types of loss, family members, friends, community leaders, and also the loss of jobs and economic security, and how we still continue to come together. And I think that it is extraordinary what people have sacrificed to be at home, to flatten this curve, and support our frontline workers. And so it's, you know, it's really was an unusual Memorial Day to think about all of that as we live through this pandemic.
Another way that it was so unusual, I mean, to put those reflections are so poignant. And at the same time, some areas of the country saw crowds at pools and beaches, and less here, but a lot of places. What do you make of how people have responded to the reopening, which at least here in the Commonwealth has widely coincided with Memorial Day, both here and in across the country?
Yes, you know, I think that it is more difficult to really understand the impact in parts of the country that haven't been hit as hard. And that is why we have such a need at this point for leadership. And unfortunately, the president has decided to remain concerned about his own polling numbers and politicizing the response instead of showing the empathy that we need him to, instead of making a plan for testing and tracing for across the country so we can safely reopen and try to find a new normal. Instead of being a role model, he refuses to wear a mask in public. And so I think that, you know, the leadership starts at the very top. And when we have a president who is telling people that this is somehow a political hoax, and even though he has changed over time with that message, there is an underlying theme that we're not to trust the science, we're not to trust the medical experts, that the only true measure of our security, whether it be healthcare or economic, is how the stock market is doing. And that.
So I don't want to spend too much time on this, Congresswoman, but because you've talked about the messaging around the science, what to say about the fact that Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx are still or have been front and center and do represent the science?
Well, I think that they do represent the science, but that is not being listened to. We have been told that testing will be available to everyone. That's still not true. We're not even testing at the 1% level that experts say we need to safely reopen this country. Like I said, the president still refuses to wear a mask and is making that really a political dividing point. We should be following the science and exactly what Dr. Fauci is saying and what, you know, other members of his scientific team, but he routinely ignores them and is not putting the policies in place and showing the leadership, acknowledging the loss and putting forward solutions on how we can reopen this economy because we have tackled the health issues. And that's where I see
Congresswoman,
the president falling short.
This is a time when widely we're seeing presidential leadership compared with gubernatorial leadership around the country. What do you make of Governor Baker's handling of the crisis and his approach to phase one of the Commonwealth's reopening?
I appreciate that Governor Baker has been listening to the experts and that he has been putting together a testing, tracing, and isolation program. It is the key to containing this virus and allowing us to get back to what I think will be a new normal, but get back to having businesses open, schools open, and trying to make sense of what's going to be our lives post-pandemic. But there are a lot of questions that still remain. And I know that it's a balance between health security and economic security, but the two go so hand in hand. And I think we need to continue to press Governor Baker to make sure that restaurants know how they will open, how they're going to stay in business. What does it mean when 25% of staff outside of Boston should report to work? Are we going to have enough PPE for people? How will faith leaders have the information they need to open their places of worship safely? And what if there is another surge? So I think that the Baker administration has done a very good job in a very difficult situation, but there are lots of continuing questions. And I think we have to put an emphasis on following the science and being great communicators.
We're talking with Congresswoman Catherine Clark. Let's take a call now, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you have a question for the Congresswoman. Andrea is on the line from Newton. Andrea, what's your question?
Hi, I'm asking about filmmakers. I'm the New England local president of Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, SAG-AFTRA. And we don't know where we are on the phases of opening for Massachusetts. And I'm wondering, are they planning on putting out where the filmmakers fall in the various stages?
Andrea, thank you for that question. And again, that is a perfect example of as we start to reopen, I can tell you that I am hearing very similar questions from many different types of industries, the arts, filmmaking, as well as our local Main Street shops and restaurants on, we need the details. We can make plans, we can adjust employee schedules, we can adjust filming schedules, but we need that kind of detail and help. And that's a great example of where I feel we need to continue working on the national level, but also here in the state to get specific information so that people know where they stand, know what they have to do to be able to financially survive this.
Congresswoman, let's talk about another key industry here in the region, which is childcare. Here in the Commonwealth, it doesn't open until at least June 29th, more than a month after the beginning of phase one reopening. I know that a couple of weeks ago, you were calling for $100 billion for the childcare industry. Connecticut, according to the Boston Globe, was just an official in Connecticut just today said that state stands to lose 45,000 childcare slots if there's not federal intervention. Can you help us put our minds around the size and the scope of that challenge and where you came to $100 billion as the right number to respond to that challenge?
Yeah, as we know, the childcare system has been under invested in for some time, and this pandemic has taken it to its breaking point. And we also know that families were already struggling to pay their bills, and they're wondering who is going to care for their children as we start to reopen. The reality is that reopening without childcare will push especially moms and women further back, and we simply can't allow that. And we have called for a very large number under any circumstances of an investment of $100 billion. But the childcare industry alone throws off $99 billion worth of economic support across the country. And we know that it is losing over $9 billion a month. And we are very afraid that childcare providers that operate on the thinnest margins in the best of times may simply not be able to reopen if they have to care for less children in order to keep everyone safe, if they have to purchase PPE, thermometers, make other adjustments around staffing that are going to make the bottom line very, very difficult for them. So we know that we are seeing chambers of commerce across Massachusetts and the country say this is a huge barrier to reopening. But unfortunately, childcare is often thought of afterwards. And we can't have an economy that's reopening while childcare is still operating under a system that it is banned from opening until after the end of June. So we want to make
sure. As I listen to you, I find myself thinking at the same time. Now, my children are older. They're not in childcare anymore. But at the same time, we know that both parents and childcare workers are so afraid of spread. And that our current home-based care and group care models are high touch, high interaction across children. Is this a time to actually dramatically rethink how childcare happens? As you note, the whole industry was struggling even before this pandemic.
It certainly was. And, you know, part of reopening our economy relies on people having faith that childcare can be provided safely. But it is also, you know, if we are going to make decisions around licensing and ratios that require less children to be served, or maybe we say certain age groups like infants may not be able to have group care at this time safely, then we have to come up with other solutions. It's not enough to say to families, you're on your own. You need to figure this out, even if this crucial support for your family has been taken away. But I agree with you. It is the time that we look at the role of childcare as one of the, you know, underpinnings of our economy and treat it as such, instead of saying it's, you know, an add-on or a nicety, and it's really up to families to figure this out on their own. If we do that, we are simply not going to have the kind of economic rebound that we need. Now is the time.
Congresswoman. I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you there, but we have a limited time. There are two other subjects that I do want to make sure we get a chance to hear from you on. And the first is another bill that you filed today, which calls on the president to appoint a medical supplies response coordinator. It's essentially a supply chain coordinator. What would that role do, and why do you feel it's necessary now?
You know, President Trump has refused to acknowledge the need for adequate medical supplies, putting our workers and patients and the public in danger. And we have seen him shift the blame, leaving states and hospitals often to compete with each other over supplies and ignoring the scientific community. So this is a bill I filed with Rep. Brad Schneider from Illinois to appoint a medical supplies response czar that would serve as that central point of authority and contact for healthcare systems, for supply chain officials, and states. And as we look not only to making sure that we continue to have medical devices like ventilators and PPE, but how are we going to get ready for what we hope will be a vaccine in the next year or so? How are we going to get ready to administer that? It takes somebody who is coordinating this, reporting weekly to Congress, so that we are communicating and putting together a strategy to ensure the healthcare of the American people and therefore ensure their financial and economic health as well.
You talked about sort of pushing the blame or the responsibility to states. Is it possible that the White House simply has a different view of the responsibilities between the federal government and state government here than you? That might be a pushback to the idea that this is an abdication of responsibility. Is it possible it's just a different interpretation of the roles of these different players?
I can't imagine what the president would define his job as if it is not helping people facing a health crisis like this pandemic. If he does not see that in his job description, if he does not see that as a role of the federal government, I'm not sure what role we have. It is that fundamental.
So I do want to shift gears one more time because we're coming up on 2 weeks since the House passed the HEROES Act, which is a $3 trillion stimulus bill, which contains a number of economic relief programs. Republicans declared it dead on arrival. Republican Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana told Fox News that the bill, quote, would rewrite our immigration laws, federalize elections. It would allow federal prisoners to go free. It mentions dope more than it talks about jobs. I think it references cannabis like 68 times. It would expand Obamacare, end quote. What's your response to that?
You know, I have been continued to be discouraged by Mitch McConnell and Republicans in the Senate and the White House and their response to this bill. This bill is about many things, and there are many things in this bill because the American people have such severe needs at this time. But at the core of it is support for state and local government. And what does that mean? That means that at this time, where we've seen state and local revenues just ravaged, is not the time to balance those budgets by cutting our police, our fire, our EMTs, our teachers, our frontline workers. And that states, I can tell you, I've talked to state officials here in Massachusetts and some from other states, and all of my mayors and town managers are saying, we need this help. And this is just not the time to be looking frontline workers and saying, we're going to balance the budget. This is what we need to do through the HEROES Act. It's where it gets its name from. And the Republicans and Mitch McConnell never fail to jump when it comes to corporate bailouts and making sure that the wealthiest Americans have what they say they need. And to hit the pause button on Americans in this time of such pain is just an abdication of their responsibility.
So the bill was 1,800 pages. Could the House pass something much leaner that focuses exclusively on these first responders and the state and local government needs and potentially get a bill passed that the Senate would also approve?
The bill also includes other things that really we have to do. One of them is feeding hungry children. We now have 1 in 5 children in this country going to bed hungry. That is unacceptable. This bill raises up those programs around SNAP and other food supports for families. And it also protects our democracy by asking for money for mail-in programs to protect the vote come November. All of these work together and are essential. We can't take one part and say we're going to support state and local governments, but we're not going to invest in continuing to expand testing and tracing programs. That is, they are so intertwined. And with every bill that we have passed, it has started in one of the House or the Senate. They've drawn up the bills. The last one was written by the Senate Republicans. And then we come together and negotiate. But now is not the time to turn our backs on the needs of families at home. And I think that we will keep the pressure on the Senate to be responsive to their constituents and meet the needs of hardworking Americans.
Congresswoman Catherine Clark of the 5th District, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
For 10 years, the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund has held a Memorial Day remembrance ceremony on Boston Common, which included reading the names of all the Massachusetts veterans who have fallen since 9/11. This year, of course, the day was commemorated without a public gathering, but an online ceremony remained just as powerful, especially with family and friends being introduced to then speak the names of their 337 fallen loved ones.
Cindy Anderson.
First Sergeant Joseph Anastasio.
Susan Brodeur.
Major David Broder.
Joseph Cook.
In addition to the online ceremony,
Timothy Doc.
The Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund organized a virtual flag garden to complement a smaller scale version displayed on the Boston Common. Radio Boston's Paris Alston joins us now to tell us more about it for our latest Paris in Boston. Paris, hello.
Hi, Tiziana, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Paris. That was powerful sound there, those names with family members reading them. And then you went to the flag garden. How was it, and how was it different this year?
Absolutely. So in normal times, volunteers and the Mass Military Heroes Fund will go out and place tens of thousands of flags to represent all our fallen heroes. But of course, due to social distancing, that couldn't happen this year. So instead, the fund asked people around the Commonwealth to post on social media, holding up flags they might have had at home or printed online, and use the hashtag Heroes Flag Garden to create the virtual garden. And so here's Tom Crowan, president of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund, talking about how in our new normal, we can still honor our fallen heroes.
We all should be bowing our heads, remembering, honoring, paying tribute, and then doing something in their honor. And we're giving people an opportunity to do that by joining us in this Heroes Flag Garden in their homes. And we're all home, or at least a lot of us are home these days. What has been inspiring to me is seeing families come together to pay their respects in a way that they probably wouldn't have done before.
And so, of course, like you mentioned, they did have the ceremony on Zoom with the families, and they read names of some of our fallen heroes. And they also, last minute, did go out on Sunday night and placed 1,000 flags on the common. And to represent our current moment, they placed them 6 feet apart. And they even had a special tribute to the veterans that we've lost due to this pandemic, including those in the soldiers' homes in Chelsea and Holyoke.
Oh, that really is quite an image. Did you see any flags?
Yeah, so if anyone goes online, they can do this too. But I did search the hashtag on social media, and you just see this outpouring of love and honor and appreciation for our fallen heroes online, with people having flags that they've posted or printed online or something they had at home, even flags that they've placed in their yard. And even up the street around the corner from where I live in Brighton, over at Brighton Marine Health Center, which is a place that serves service members and their families, they do a flag garden every year. And so this is something that they definitely wanted to continue. And I spoke with Bob Notch, who is a veteran himself. He's a retired Army colonel, and he's also program development officer there. He organized this effort, and he talked about how he wants the flag garden to be visible and to really allow people to stop and think about their role in remembering fallen heroes.
We can now participate from our homes or our offices in that flag garden through the virtual flag garden. And I believe it allows all of us, no matter where we live and how close we are to the actual physical placement of flags on Boston Common, that we are now part of that remembrance.
Paris, how did families and supporters respond? I mean, things are so different this year.
Yes, absolutely. So inevitably, they were sad that it wasn't the same, because that ceremony on the common, especially for the families who have lost someone in war, it's really special for them to stand out together and to hear those names read. But they were glad that it was still going on. And I spoke to a couple families, and their whole thing was, people promised that they would never forget. And this year they didn't, even with everything going on. So that was really important. I did speak with Stephen Zabrick, who's from Chelmsford. He's the Gold Star father of Marine Corporal Andrew Zabrick, who was killed in action in Iraq in 2004. And this past Thursday, marked the 16th anniversary of his death, which was also the day that the virtual ceremony happened. And here's what Stephen Zabrick had to say about the change in commemoration this year.
They've done the flag garden now for 10 years, and we've been there since the beginning. And it means a lot to us. I have a flag in my backyard for my son, and I held up that, they had a handheld flag. So I submitted that picture of my personal flag garden at home.
And, you know, something else that struck me, Tiziana, as I was talking to some of these families, is that if you remember a couple weeks ago, we had a regular guest on our show, Steve Cazella, and he was on to talk about a poll that he'd done of Massachusetts nurses. And It just so happens that Steve Cazella is also an Iraq war veteran. And he kind of likened how a lot of these nurses talking about being on the front lines of a war zone, and he himself having experienced that, kind of made that analogy as well. And of course, we know that nothing compares. None of us could ever imagine what it's like to be on the front lines of actual war and to know the sacrifices. None of us have made that sacrifice that some of our service members have had to make. But even Stephen Zabrick likened this pandemic to a war. And he noted that there are different heroes dying and making sacrifices right now. But he did have something to say about how we can honor what our frontline workers, essential workers are doing, and also think about that kind of in the context of how we honor our fallen heroes like his son, Andrew.
In 2004, when Andrew died in Iraq, the town of Chelmsford, it was unbelievable. They came out in such great force and were so supportive. It was just unbelievable. Well, all of America has to rally around this cause, because it affects everybody.
And, you know, we're just always going to continue to remember that, Tiziana, even as things begin to open back up and we try to work into this new normal.
That's Radio Boston's Paris Alston. Paris, thanks.
Thank you.
You know, things changed last week. Businesses began to reopen, stay at home became safer at home. And suddenly some of what we do and don't do is once again really up to us. Now, chances are, if you're anything like our team here at Radio Boston, you've been thinking nonstop about that. How do you navigate the new normal? What's safe to do and when? How do you begin seeing the people you value and love the most? What's okay, scientifically, socially, for you personally? For the rest of the hour, that's what we want to talk about. We want to invite you to pull up a chair. How did you spend the long weekend? Was it with loved ones, or did you stay at home? How are you negotiating the new normal? How are you dealing with finding community and figuring out what's best for your family? And are you seeing others make different choices? Maybe going to each other's houses when you didn't, or not wearing masks when you are. And how are you handling that? It's all on the table. Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two people joining us to help have this conversation. First is Boston Globe reporter Beth Tytel. Welcome back, Beth.
Thanks. So glad to be part of your conversation.
Glad to have you. And also with us is Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Welcome back, Reverend Mariama.
Good to be here.
So, Reverend Mariama, I want to start with you. I want to ask you first how you are, and also, what did you see going on in your neighborhood this weekend as Massachusetts really kind of felt like it began to open up in earnest?
Yeah, so I'm doing well. And I live in Dorchester in the zip code 02125. I've been paying attention, so I know that we are actually one of the zip codes that's been having an increase in cases recently. And so I've been trying to be extremely careful, but as the weather warmed up, I saw lots of people outside. Unfortunately, I saw many of them without masks. I also heard from one of my parishioners who came by to pick up a plant, that there was there were traffic jams over by Carson Beach in Southie. I go there often because we live about, you know, 3/4 of a mile from there. So I go there to run. Definitely concerned about the number of people taking lawn chairs out. She said some of them had on masks, but, you know, I think there's a lot of confusion because people think like if you wear a mask, then you don't have to socially distance. So I think there's quite a bit of confusion. I think, you know, it's warm, it's sunny, people want to get out. My mother is, we joke, she is now in that elderly age, but both my parents are physicians. I spent last week spending a lot of time listening to epidemiologists as we tried to figure out whether or not to open our congregation. And I'm sincerely concerned that we are starting our way back to another resurgence. And so it's really challenging because I know we all want to see each other, but it's a tough time.
Beth, how about you? Did you see the same? Did you have a different experience? And what did you do this weekend?
You know, listening to this, it makes me really think that we're all kind of like kids again, where people are saying, but everybody else is doing it. I think the more people are seeing out doing things, the greater both the social pressure to do things becomes, and also your internal clock, your internal sense of what feels right changes a little bit. Like you hear a good friend who you trust, well, maybe they got takeout, which you hadn't thought was safe. And now you're thinking that's okay. I've seen a lot of people wearing masks around where I have been, which I think makes people feel good. And then you see somebody running by without a mask. And of course, since we really are all in this together, that's where I think a lot of the anger stems from. This is a really confusing time, I think, and a stressful time for families, because you could have a family with 2, 3, 4 more people. Each person might have a different sense of what's okay, and you're all living under the same roof.
You know, and listening to the two of you, here's what I find myself thinking, and I've been thinking this a lot lately. We seem to have a gap between what's allowed and what at a given place and time we think is okay. And that can vary by person to person. So let's just take two things. One thing Beth just talked about and one thing Reverend Mariama just talked about. Beth, you said maybe one person is taking takeout while someone else doesn't think that's okay. But takeout has been something that's been allowed all the way along. And Reverend Mariama, you talked about people being out and not wearing masks. And what we don't know is, were they safely social distanced? Were they, you know, 3 feet away from each other and not wearing masks, or 30 feet away from each other and not wearing masks? Because again, that second thing is allowed, but some people still don't find it safe. So how do we as a human community navigate it when there's all that room for disagreement and interpretation?
I mean, I think one of the big challenges is that it says when you're not able to socially distance, that was one of the things that the governor said. And my concern is, you don't know that you're going to be not able to socially distance until it's happening. You go out, it looks, if you look down your street, it looks empty. You go out and you walk, you have no idea what's going to be on the other side of that. And so I think that's where it's getting a little tricky, is that I think people have every intention of following. Well, I think many people have every intention of following the guidelines, but you don't know that you won't be able to follow them until the moment happens. And so I think, as an example, when we talked about whether or not to open church, one of the things we talked about is like, are we really capable as a community of not hugging each other? It's such a part of our practice. We were worried that to ask people not to do that was a setup. Children are such a key part of our service. And I don't think it's fair that to ask them to socially distance. So I think, you know, this question of like what we intend to do and what is actually realistic, I feel like sometimes we're not being honest enough with ourselves about whether or not we can follow the guidelines
I'd love to get Beth's reaction to all of that. Beth.
You know, I think that's such a great point you make, Reverend, about being realistic. I'm looking right now at the guidelines that the state is sharing with childcare providers for when they either start to open or people are providing emergency care right now. And one of the guidelines says, regards social distancing. Children should be kept 6 feet apart and frequently reminded not to touch their faces, hug, high five, or have any other physical contact. Refrain from activities that encourage physical contact or close proximity like tag or circle time. I mean, it's so one thing to say this is the rule. And then if you've been with a child, it would be absurd to, how are you possibly monitoring that?
You're basically saying don't be a kid. That is exactly what children do.
Yeah. I think another problem is that everybody wants to assess risk. What's my risk of doing this? But the problem is that we have no way of knowing. Like in the beginning of the pandemic, we were told, don't wear masks, they don't help you. Now we have learned that they do. But so people don't even know what to trust. Like, for example, you think, oh, takeout's fine, it's safe. But on the other hand, the restaurants have a vested interest, of course, and I am complete support of that, of wanting there to be takeout because they need that lifeline. But how are you supposed to know? Like, what if somebody who's making your food coughs on it? So does that help that they're wearing gloves? I think it's very difficult for each, and people have a different tolerance for risk and a different assessment of how important something is to them. So you have to decide, and that's what makes it so confusing.
Let's bring in our first listener voice here. And listeners, we really invite you to join this conversation. What did you see this weekend? How did you feel about it? What choices are you making now about what you do, who you see, where and how you see them? Has that changed, or do you anticipate that it will change in the next few weeks? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with Dave from Dedham. Dave, go ahead.
How are you doing? Well, I spent the weekend on the Cape. On Saturday, we went out to the Race Point. It was a spectacular day because it was so horrible. I got my hair cut yesterday down in Hyannis. And I think what we're going to have to deal with is, like, when you go to the beach and you want to go in the water, and the water, you might be cold, but you're not quite sure. So you kind of go into your ankles and you get your feet wet, and it's not too bad. You go a little bit further and you get up to your knees, and, oh, Jesus, it's really cold. You run out. Otherwise, you just keep going in and you get used to it. And at some point in the next few weeks to a month or so, we're just going to get used to it. If nothing bad happens, I mean, that's the problem. Everyone thinks something bad's going to happen. But if nothing bad happens and we go along this kind of way, I think we'll be fine.
Thanks for that, Dave. And I want to invite both of our panelists to respond to that. The cold water analogy is a vivid one. We know exactly what that feels like and how we do that. Is that the right analogy for the moment we're in?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the big challenges is, are you assessing the risk to yourself, or are you assessing the risk to those people who are most vulnerable? You know, I myself think if I get COVID, there's a good chance I'll be able to, you know, I'll probably have a really bad bout and I'll be okay. But one of my really great active parishioners is recovering from cancer and lung cancer at that. For me, this question of, I'm less afraid of getting COVID and much more concerned about being the person that passes it on. I just got a bereavement notice yesterday morning, but a pastor who for Mother's Day went to go see his aunt, who's in her 90s, felt like that was safe to do. Unfortunately, her home health aide had COVID, which she passed on both to the aunt and to him. He accidentally passed to his wife and daughter, and he passed away yesterday.
Mm.
So I think for me, the biggest, always biggest concern is the possibility of passing it on. Another family I know got together around the death of their grandmother. 16 people in the family ended up with COVID. So I think this challenge is, you don't know what the risk is until the other side. And I don't want to be alarmist, but when you as a pastor are counseling people through these really hard moments, it provides a different side of the picture, really guilt that people feel when they pass it on.
I'd like to bring another call in here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Teresa on the line. My screen, I'm remote, and my screen has cut off where she's from, so I can't quite tell where you're from, Teresa, but maybe you can tell us.
Hi, sure. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I live down on the Cape in South Chatham.
Thanks.
And I was just wanted to I wanted to kind of follow up on what the speaker was talking about as far as child care goes. The reality of what kids will do when they're in a confined situation, I think, is apparent for a lot more parents right now. But we have not yet received any specific regulations from the state regarding reopening childcare centers. And I think that there's needs to be a lot more time spent on seeing if what the COVID models that, or the precautionary models to keep adults safe, really is going to be something that applies or even works in a childcare setting. We're down on the Cape and we're planning to hopefully open up something that will support parents who can't work from home and have to go back into the workforce. But it's like, it's as though we're asked to be designing a model that inherently won't work, number one. And we're pretty creative people working on it.
Let me take it back from you there, Teresa, because you've given us some great stuff to work with there. And we can add to that the conversation we had earlier this hour with Congresswoman Catherine Clark, where we were talking about, is this a time where, given the realities of the virus, we have to rethink how we even do childcare in a group setting. Beth, how many, do you remember how many pages was the list of regulations that you were looking at and that Teresa is calling about?
It was, there's a lot. There's a lot for the daycare providers I was to deal with. I was just talking with a woman who runs an at-home daycare center in at her home. And she was talking about one of the biggest changes she sees is in the kitchen area, where the kids like to pretend that they're running a restaurant. And she had 12 buckets of you know, little plastic steaks and tacos and, you know, squirt fried eggs. And that's what it used to be. And now she's only can use one of those little buckets of food, and kids can only do stuff basically by themselves. And their kids are saying, I want to make a taco. Where's the frying pan? They're really missing it. So, but she's, you know, with the weather's nice now, so she's focusing them outside. Like, they're spending a lot of time outside, which is great. It takes a lot more creativity and people getting used to, I guess that's a lot of what it is. And then on the other hand, you have a lot of need for childcare. Mm-hmm. So you can't have these smaller, you know, who knows whether the smaller groups will really work, because you have so many parents obviously who need to get to work and have their children looked after in a nice way.
And childcare, another call. My husband works a lot around this. They're very fragile businesses. So if we don't figure out how to shore them up now, my concern is that some of them won't be here on the other side of this.
Yeah, once again, we saw a report earlier today that in Connecticut, they're saying they risk 45,000 childcare slots if they don't receive some sort of federal financial support in the state for those operations. I want to take another call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Ella on the line from Newton. Ella, what's on your mind?
Well, as I said before, I grew up in post-war Poland. My parents were Holocaust survivors. And they told me stories. They said that when the Second World War, when it just started, everybody was saying, oh, it will blow over in a few months. And then it took 5 years. So I decided for myself and my family, this is like war, and you have to be prepared for the long haul. And what you do in the war is you survive. And children are resilient. I know, you know, we have a lot of things that are helpful. We have Zoom. We have internet, and we can survive this, and we have to be careful. And, you know, you read the post-war stories about children locked up. Read Anne Frank. Read with children the diary of Anne Frank. I mean, you know, they could have survived in that apartment. They lived in there for, I don't know, 2 years. I don't remember. Read it a long time ago. Anyway, this is my take.
Well, thank you for that take, Ella. Reverend Mariama, that is deep. Are we in a moment that's similar to war? What do you find yourself thinking when you hear Ella's call?
Well, I mean, the way I've been looking at it is this. Even before this, I do a lot of work around issues of inequality, climate change. There were huge things that we needed to deal with in our world. And so I actually, I've been calling it COVID transformation time. that's the way I help to refocus myself and ask myself the question, how can I be growing? How can we be learning in this time? And I think my suggestion to my parishioners is focus on the things that you can do. Focus on the ways that you can grow so that you don't actually give all your energy to what you're losing and missing. I've been encouraging people, grow food at home. Start a backyard garden or put some flowers on your windowsill. How do we find ways to put our energy towards things that are safe, things that we maybe didn't have time for in the past, but that we can cultivate in this time? And I think Ella's perspective is great. We as human beings can be resilient. But I think for those folks who are just trying to get back to normal, I worry that that's just a recipe to have continuing waves of infection.
Sorry, I was having trouble with a button there for a second. Sorry for that pause. We have 3 minutes left. I'd like to try to get one more call in. We have Bill on the line from Hamilton. Bill, briefly, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going? No, I'm just stating my level of anxiety. I've never had been an anxious person in my life. But my wife was due on Saturday. She's a few days late. But all the telehealth and not being able to go into the hospital as often to get proper checkups for her has been a pretty unnerving. Also, quickly, a friend of mine's father, who went in with multiple, all the symptoms, tested 3 times negative, never tested positive, and passed away on the third day. And they labeled it clinical COVID. It's making me, real nervous about trying to have a healthy kid in the hospital and come home safely and then not being able to share the baby with anybody or who knows about daycare when that's going to happen. But I own a business. My wife's a nurse and we're limited on family. So it's been extremely stressful.
I appreciate you sharing that anxiety with us. I'm sorry to cut you short. We're up against the clock. We will be thinking about you and your wife and your baby to come. We have about a minute and a half left. And Beth, I just want to give you one more word here on the level of anxiety you're seeing as you report and talk to people.
As the caller just talked about, there's that type of anxiety, which is, I'm so sorry, that's just so real and so visceral. And there's also, I think, there's a lot of anxiety, particularly right now. People are seeing statistics showing that states that have opened up starting in April or early May are actually seeing new waves. So people are very afraid that people around them are going to be doing things that they might not want to do and bringing the illness here, or colleges opening. Like Boston College has said it's having students on campus in the fall. I know that's making a lot of people in that neighborhood nervous. So when I was talking to different people about strategies to cope, and one thing that came up repeatedly was meditation.
Beth, we've only got a couple seconds here. Sorry. Go just quickly. No, finish just quickly, Beth.
I was just saying that people, it sounds, it's like something you'd read in a self-help book, but it's actually true. People say that to focus on what you can control and really try to learn a little bit of mindfulness, even just a couple minutes a day, can actually help.
All right. Thanks for that. That's Beth Titel of the Boston Globe and Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.